edibles are approved to hit the market in Florida as calls for cannabis reform grow louder. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest on cannabis in the Sunshine State and the role it could play in the presidential election. Get on the line and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, a look at the new campaign in the city of Jax to get many more people vaccinated against the flu. But first this hour, here is the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. 200 new deaths reported around the state overnight from coronavirus, including 10 in our area. There are now more than 652,000 reported cases of the virus around the state. Amidst this news, medical marijuana is now making headlines once again here in the Sunshine State. Edible medical marijuana products are on the market here. 4 years after Florida voters first approved the legalization of medical marijuana. And cannabis reform appears to be influential in the upcoming election, too. The Biden-Harris campaign says it wants to fully decriminalize marijuana. At the same time, President Donald Trump has told Republicans around the country to keep marijuana legalization off ballots if they can. The president reportedly fears that cannabis measures could drive Democratic turnout and lose him the election. Here's the thing, though. Cannabis reform is popular with a majority of Americans of all political persuasions. So how is this playing out? With more, we're pleased to welcome back to the show Jacksonville attorney Sally Kent Peebles, a partner with the cannabis firm Vicente Cederberg. She's also a member of the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Sally, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
And already getting your calls about cannabis and edibles in Florida, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. In a moment, I want to ask you about the election and how cannabis might be a factor. But first, can you tell us where things stand with the approval of edible products for medical marijuana in Florida? What's available and why did it take so long?
Absolutely. So this is really exciting. As everyone knows, the state legalized full THC medical marijuana back in 2016, and edibles were actually permitted under that law, but the Department of Health never drafted the edibles. There's been a lot of discussion why. The testing rules had not been crafted yet, nor had the packaging and labeling rules, and you really want those to come out first, or at least simultaneously. So they just released testing rules recently, and now we have the edible packaging rules following that.
Okay. And what kinds of products are now available to Florida consumers?
So a lot of these edible rules, as we see with other states, the purpose of them is to really protect public health and mainly keep these products from children and make sure they're not attractive to children. So the types and the forms of edibles really are guided by those policies. So they'll only be allowed in certain forms, like lozenges, gelatins, baked goods, chocolate, drink powders. You will not see any meat or poultry or fish. Those would not be allowed. None of the edibles can be mixed with any other additives that would increase their potency or increase their psychoactive abilities. So you won't see any marijuana-infused nicotine or marijuana-infused alcohol or caffeine. No items that must be refrigerated will be allowed. So unfortunately, we won't see any infused ice creams anytime soon in Florida. Edibles aren't going to be able to have any sort of decor, and that, again, goes to not wanting them to be attracted to children. So they cannot contain any color additives, can't be bright colors. They cannot bear any resemblance to other commercially available candy. And that really is because we don't want these marijuana edibles to be confusing for the consumer. You want to reduce consumer confusion, not have them look anything like any other candy on the market. So when you pick that up, you know you've got THC in that product. And all these products will have to be marked with a universal symbol that the Department of Health has crafted, signifying this product has THC in it. No decorating, sprinkles, icing, nothing to make it cute and fun that would be attractive to a child.
obviously, Sally, this is a huge market that's now finally in Florida, and there will be great demand for these products. If you are already approved to obtain medical marijuana through the process the state has set up, are you automatically eligible to go out and buy this new form of THC, or do you need to go through a process?
Now, a couple things. Not only does the patient need to go back to their doctor and get approved for this route of administration, and that might be easily done pretty quickly. Of course, they're going to ask for another fee, most likely. But also, not only does the patient have to do that, but the MMTCs, now that they have the rules, have to go to the Department of Health and get each one of the edibles they want to produce approved. So that's going to create some lag time with these dispensaries being able to offer these. I've talked to a few of my clients in the last 24 hours just in preparation for this, and I've been told a week to 2 weeks to really get them on the shelf.
All right. And we're speaking with cannabis attorney Sally Kent Peebles about edibles hitting the market in Florida and the politics of cannabis reform. We'll go to your calls in a moment. It's 549-2937. Let's talk about the election. The Biden-Harris campaign is in favor of full decriminalization of cannabis. The Trump campaign, by contrast, the president has worried openly about marijuana legalization efforts on ballots around the country and concerned that it could affect his outcome in those states. How significant an issue do you think cannabis is when it comes to our presidential politics?
Well, we see that about 60% of Republicans do support marijuana legalization, but you have in the hot almost 80% for Democrats. And of course, as you stated, the idea here is that putting a high-profile issue on the ballot that's popular with Democrats are going to drive voter turnout to those polls. This is something we saw Republicans did back in 2012. You know, if you remember, they put gay marriage bans on the ballot back then to really drive Republican turnout. And this year, it will be interesting to see if this theory actually plays out. And we'll be able to do that because two states that are typically red states, Montana and Arizona, both have marijuana issues on the ballot this year. So we'll be able to have a front row seat to see if this theory really plays out and switches them from red to blue.
Let's talk, too, about how cannabis reform goes hand in hand with criminal justice reform. The Biden-Harris campaign wants to decriminalize cannabis altogether. They want to expunge prior cannabis records. Harris is a former prosecutor, so she has had a complicated history with this issue. But she's also the lead Senate sponsor on what's known as the MORE Act, the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act. Can you explain what this legislation would do, Sally?
Absolutely. This is an incredibly exciting piece of legislation. Well, as you know, marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, and it's listed as a Schedule I substance on the Controlled Substances Act. And the MORE Act aims to correct this by decriminalizing marijuana at the federal level. It removes it entirely from the CSA. Critically, it requires the federal courts to expunge prior convictions for cannabis offenses. This is what we see Kamala Harris really supporting expungement of criminal records is so critical because people with a criminal record can lose their ability to get student loans, affect their ability to get quality public housing. It can even affect their interest rates when they're going to get insurance or loans, affect some sort of a lot of professional certifications. So it can really handicap a person. And the MORE Act, it affects the drug war moving forward. It also addresses the past wrongs. Social justice issues are really front and center right now with the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests, and the MORE Act seeks to really right some of those historic wrongs by leveling the playing field. It's going to give a leg up to those affected by the drug war.
Let's go to your calls now as we talk about edibles on the market in Florida and cannabis reform. Where do you stand? 549-2937. Bill at the Beaches. Hi, Bill. Let's start with you.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
How are you? Yeah, in regards to a couple of things, the politicization of this issue, it doesn't matter if one side came out and said they like shiny days, the other side would come out and say that they like rain. So there's always going to be a back and forth as far as that goes. I think there should be full decriminalization of marijuana across the board in regards to medicinal as well as recreational. Say you have a person who's out there, they have a medicinal need but can't get access to either a doctor, they can't get in fast enough, they go out, they get their marijuana, edible, smokable, whatever it is, through another means, then they're at risk for, you know, criminal an infraction, possibly incarceration. And the long-term issues with selling that illegally are the people that do it, because they're out there, they have weapons, they have things to protect their stash, they have protect their business. If we decriminalize this, we can tax these products, we can put more money into the, you know, tax coffers, and we can also avoid these other criminals that are out there selling it.
Thanks, Bill. Certainly, that's the argument this reform movement has been making for quite some time. That's Bill at the Beaches. Sally Kent Peebles, as you pointed out, increasingly, this is an argument that liberals, moderates, and conservatives agree on. This has broad bipartisan support, which is remarkable considering how quickly this issue has moved with the American voters. Why do you think it's finally reached this sort of tipping point where the majority of Americans are in favor of decriminalization? They like the idea of taxing this product, expunging records for people who have, had a conviction for a small amount of possession in the past and so on. Why do you think this is tipped in the American psyche?
Well, I think, you know, our law firm played a critical role in legalizing marijuana back in 2014. We were the first state to do it. And I think, we were the guinea pig.
And
you mean
Colorado. That's where your firm is based.
Yes, my firm is based back when I was in Colorado. I'm now in Florida. Since then, I think we were kind of the guinea pigs. Colorado was the guinea pigs. And the rest of the country and the world had all their eyes on us. And they thought the sky might fall. And it didn't. Instead, we created jobs. It was a great source of tax revenue. Teen use of marijuana went down. You know, everyone was so scared that everyone would be easier to get. Actually, it's not easier to get because now your kid is going to have to get, ID'd to get it, right? We're going to see the benefits of legalization has been touted now to be so positive that I think anyone who goes against it is going to look silly. Marijuana prohibition has failed. Regulation works. And I think other states want a piece of that economic pie as well.
On Twitter, May asks, what's the tax benefit to legalizing and regulating recreational marijuana? The Netherlands did this over 40 years ago, and as a result, their crime is low and users know what they are buying. What about that, Sally?
Absolutely. Crime can go down. You see actually crime rates around dispensaries go down because security has really risen due to the regulation of it. They have to have security guards. They have to have cameras. And I mean, he points to the revenue that this is going to get from the taxes. So while medical is not taxed in Florida, if we have adult use marijuana in Florida, we would tax that like we did in Colorado and other states. And it can be a great source of revenue.
Brian tweets the show, where is Florida on reconsidering its model of vertical integration? Like several states, Florida requires that cannabis licensees, operate multiple stages of the supply chain from cultivation to dispensary. Can you explain a little bit about that, the business model for delivering this product to Florida buyers?
Absolutely. In some states, you can get a license just to, say, cultivate marijuana or dispense marijuana. In other states, like Florida, we have required vertical integration, which means one license, one licensee, one team is in control of the entire process from seed to sale. That makes it very expensive for a business owner to do because they have to grow it. They have to build out the dispensaries, build out the cultivation. Hire people to do all that. That also has the effect of making only the very rich, you know, get one of these licenses because it's very expensive to run. In Florida, this part of the statute has been challenged as part of the floor-grown suit. This suit has is going to be heard by the Supreme Court. It's actually in front of the Supreme Court now. They asked for a second set of oral arguments later this fall in October. And so we'll see how that plays out. If Foregrown wins and vertical integration is seen as unconstitutional, we may in the next year or so see vertical integration dissembled and the ability to just for the everyday person to get a license to grow it or sell it.
Lots of tweets, emails, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. What do you think about edibles, medical marijuana edibles now being on the market in Florida? What are your questions? It's 549-2937 as we speak with cannabis attorney Sally Kent Peebles. So, it's remarkable to note that the voters 4 years ago overwhelmingly spoke to the powers that be in this state, Sally, and said they want this product. It's taken a really long time for this product to get approved. The legislature has really dragged its feet, I think it's fair to say, on heeding the will of the voters on this. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that edibles have often gotten a bad rap. They certainly have gotten some negative press in other states. I don't know. I think the New York Times, Maureen Dowd, did an article back in 2014 about how she had a bad experience in a hotel that kind of went viral. And I think it's important for people to understand that edibles can be consumed responsibly, but they are very different from flower and concentrates. So when you, there are a lot of factors that come into play that will control a consumer's experience with marijuana, the strain or the amount of cannabinoids. But most critical to how you're affected is your consumption method. When you smoke, it goes into your lungs. The cannabinoids are immediately absorbed into your bloodstream and into your brain. It's going to affect you pretty much instantaneously, and it's going to last for 1 to 2 hours. Edibles, however, when you
go ahead.
When you eat them, sorry.
Go ahead.
So edibles, when you eat them, are going to go through your digestive tract, absorbed by your stomach, and then metabolized in your liver. And what that really means, it's just going to take a lot longer to affect you. And what the tricky part is, some people get in trouble when they take edibles because they take it. And since it doesn't hit them immediately like they're used to when they smoke it, it takes more time to hit them. And they'll take more thinking, oh, it never hit me. So people sometimes have negative effects with edibles. So I think when a state goes to regulate these products, they're very hesitant. They want to make sure it's done right, so that the consumer doesn't have those negative effects. They want to put certain safeguards in place.
So as edibles hit the market and medical marijuana is now available throughout the state, activists on the ground pushing cannabis reform are pushing for full legalization of marijuana in Florida for recreational use as well. How many states have legalized weed for recreational use, and where is the effort in Florida?
11 states have fully legalized adult use marijuana. In Florida, we've discussed this in the past, there's been a few efforts, and really funding was the problem. A lot of people were supportive of it. I don't think it was lack of support that didn't get it all the way to the ballot. I mean, these are very expensive campaigns to run, to the $10, $15 million tune. So we really need a deep-pocketed funder to get behind these. In Florida specifically, we need a supermajority, a 60% vote to pass adult-use marijuana in Florida, and no state, none of those 11 states, none of the states that passed through a ballot initiative have ever gotten that high of a percentage. They've gotten highs in the 50s, but none has gotten over 60%. That is a very high threshold to get. While it might be difficult, the path might be difficult in Florida, I do believe we'll see it. If not in 2022, then definitely in 2024.
Meantime, Joanna tweets the show, I make my own edibles as I can make different strengths for different levels of pain. I would like to see the prices go down and patients should be allowed to grow their own. Insurance doesn't cover any of this. Let's keep in mind the whole impetus to pass medical marijuana reform in Florida was to help people with a variety of medical conditions, cancer, chronic pain, epilepsy, you name it. And as we're seeing from listeners, they would like the ability to grow their own product to treat what ails them. That's not currently legal for the most part. And they want insurance, Sally, to better cover this product. Where do things stand there?
Most of the issues you just pointed out are really going to have to wait for federal legalization. You're not going to have any sort of medical insurance coverage for these products until the federal government ends marijuana prohibition, which hopefully we will see under Biden and Harris. Things like home grow, I am firmly supportive of that. You know, I think patients should have the ability to grow for personal use a small number of plants so that they can make their own medicine. Some of these patients are very, very sick, and they don't have the money to spend at the dispensaries. And think if we really care about patients, I think that's something that Florida should consider. I mean, Colorado has that in place, as does Oregon. And I think if we press for federal legalization, I think the rest of these protections will fall into place. But, you know, the employment issues and insurance issues, things like that, are really going to wait for federal legalization.
Okay. What is the last piece of advice you have for people who are still getting up to speed on how medical marijuana is regulated and sold? What do they need to do if they decide they need this product?
They should go get a patient card, go see their doctor, get a patient card, and go to dispensaries. Look at what's out there. Educate yourself. A lot of these MMTCs have great educational programs in place that will teach patients about consumption and dosing and all the important things they need to protect themselves. You know, education is key. Try different things out. See what works for you. I think, and critically, you need to vote. Get out there and vote. Honestly, between the presidential candidates, Biden and Harris are the ones that are going to get us to federal legalization quicker. Trump hasn't shut us down. He supports states' rights, but he also hasn't taken a lot of steps to legalize it either, to go ahead and end federal prohibition. So use your ability to vote.
Andrew in Orange Park has a question. Hi, Andrew. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Quick question. You know, one thing, I understand the whole fact of not allowing insurance to have it just because on the federal level, but even maybe lowering the price or getting something together where it is more affordable for just, you know, the working class, just the average person, because I was looking to get it. I almost lost my leg at the hip and still deal with a lot of pain. As we all know, opioids are, you know, pretty bad to be getting on. It would be nice to have an alternative that doesn't cost an arm and a leg to be able to get on and be able to use. I was looking at it. It's over $200, close to $300 for a doctor's appointment, plus all the state fees and, you know, the continuous going to the doctors every 3 months. So that's just something I would like to see, maybe, if we can't get it on insurance as a nationwide thing, or, you know.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Sure.
Yep.
It's expensive. This is still a very expensive product, Sally. Do you think the prices will come down at some point?
So the key there is that vertical integration I mentioned earlier. While vertical integration is still in place in Florida, it's going to be tough for those prices to come down because, like I said, these companies are being asked to pay for and control the entire seed to sale process. It's a very expensive process with a lot of overhead. And for them to make a profit, the medicine needs to be more expensive, unfortunately. If you go to other states that have that capitalism is allowed to reign and competition, there's so many dispensaries and so many cultivations, and these companies are in competition with each other, that's going to naturally force those prices down, and you're going to have more product on the shelves, more diversity. You're going to have more creativity in the product. Vertical integration works in some ways, but when it comes to pricing and product availability, it really can hamper things.
It's always good to get your insights as we talk about this issue. Again, edibles are now on the medical marijuana market in Florida. And our cannabis expert is Sally Kent Peoples, partner in the cannabis firm Vicente Cederberg, on the line for us. Sally, always good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Later, the launch of new public art celebrating Jacksonville's musical heroes. We'll tell you where you can see it. But up next.
This year in particular, we are very, very concerned about hospitalization rates in the fall because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
And that's why there's a campaign to get everyone in this city vaccinated against the flu. We'll tell you about the Flu Vax Jax movement after this.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
I'm Agata Gardner, and I'm a volunteer on WJCT's Community Advisory Board. I grew up listening to public radio, and my son now is starting to value it. He'll ask follow-up questions that make it clear to me that he gets it, that that's a complicated issue, and I think it is starting in his own little six-year-old mind to make him realize that the world isn't black and white. And I think that WJCT does a really great job in bringing integrity to the news. This is WJCT News 89.9.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. Well, a coalition of community groups has partnered with the City of Jax this week to launch a new campaign called Flu Vax Jax. The goal is to dramatically increase the rate of influenza vaccinations in this area. That's because there could be another surge of COVID-19 in the fall, with more people crowding into hospitals just as flu season hits. And so if there are more COVID-19 patients filling up ICU beds, the system will be strained when it comes to treating flu patients. So lowering rates of flu is pretty important. For more about FluVax Jax, I spoke with Dr. Sunil Joshi, president of the Duval Medical Society Foundation. Hey, Dr. Joshi, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So a big push to get the word out about flu vaccinations this week. Tell us a little more about the Flu Vax Jax campaign.
Yeah, so this year in particular, we are very, very concerned about hospitalization rates in the fall because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as a result of that, we're worried that if our hospitals get over full, we're going to have an issue with our healthcare system in general. And so what typically ends up filling up our hospitals in the fall and the winter months is respiratory viruses. And the most common and most severe respiratory virus is the flu, influenza. And fortunately, with the flu, which we don't have for COVID-19, as for the flu, we do have a time-tested vaccine that is safe and effective and can keep people out of the hospital. And so if we can increase our vaccination numbers in Northeast Florida, we would then expect, in turn, that our hospitalization rates for the flu would decrease. And if that occurs, we would have enough space to treat any of the very sick COVID patients who may require hospitalization. So that's why the push is necessary this year, is to do what we can to keep people healthy and out of the hospital. So those who may be suffering with COVID and other non-preventable ailments can have the room when needed.
So this is really an unprecedented collaboration of groups coming together to really get those vaccination rates up. And that's driven by the pandemic. How seriously are you worried about what we might be seeing this flu season in our hospitals and with the population?
Yeah. Definitely concerned, because if you look back at previous years, or you talk to hospitals about previous years, when do we typically see the biggest surge in patients coming into the hospital? At what points of the year do we tend to get close to capacity? And it's almost always in the late fall and the winter months, which is when respiratory viruses tend to go through our community. And the kids go back to school, colleges are in session, people are traveling in and out of Florida for the holidays, for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And so we tend to see an increase in these respiratory viruses that cause significant illnesses in the late fall and winter months. And so we reach very close to capacity in those scenarios. And then if you add this new virus pandemic, the COVID patients who, you know, were filling up hospitals in New York City and China and were filling up our hospitals earlier this summer, you can see where we could be in a really difficult spot. Keep in mind, hospitals are doing the best they can with contingency plans, but we don't want to get to that point where we're having to utilize satellite hospital beds or even having to send patients to Gainesville or other parts of Florida just to manage their health.
Hmm. So with all of that said, then, how can people easily and safely get their flu vaccination this season?
Yeah, so, you know, just like in every typical flu season, you know, going to your local pharmacy, seeing your primary care provider, your pediatrician are all options for folks to get vaccinated. The Department of Health also offers vaccines. There will be a vaccination programs coming to public schools so that our public school children can be vaccinated if the parents choose to do that. The hospitals, you know, provide vaccines for their employees and people who have been hospitalized. So we are hoping that we're going to have a widespread outreach clinic, mobile clinics, where private pharmacies will go out into communities, in particular communities of need, to provide the vaccine in those areas where folks in the past have not been vaccinated. You know, we want to increase vaccination in particular in our uninsured population.
Well, there's more at the website fluvaxjax.com. And thank you, Dr. Sunil Joshi. He is president of the Duval County Medical Society Foundation and also president of the Family Allergy Asthma Consultants. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, September is Hunger Action Month, a month set aside to celebrate people all over America standing up to hunger. And the need for food assistance is at an all-time high right now. Here's why. Millions of people in America are hungry all the time, but the coronavirus pandemic has caused even more families to struggle. Feeding America estimates some 54 million people may be food insecure in 2020. Including 18 million children. About 4 in 10 people now visiting a food bank say they're coming in because of COVID-19. So what can we do about all this? We're pleased to welcome Susan King, who heads up Feeding Northeast Florida. She's on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning, Melissa.
And you know, Feeding Northeast Florida, which is an arm of Feeding America, is an incredibly important organization and does vital work all of the time. But right now, with this pandemic, you are more pressed than ever. Can you describe the situation out in our region? How critical is the need?
Well, you know, it's been kind of mind-boggling. When we thought this was going to be weeks and turning into months, we've seen approximately a 30 to 40% increase in the number of food insecure individuals in our 8-county service area. We're about 325,000 people that we estimate are don't know necessarily where their next meal is coming from. We are probably 2 to 3 times seeing the demand increase as reported by our agency partners. And they are reporting that approximately 50 to 60%, and that's pretty vague, some of them report much higher, are people who have never accessed charity food before. So it's a real shift in how we are serving and who we are serving. I will tell you, just from a big number standpoint, we were doing approximately 1 million meals, about 1.2 million pounds, in an average month. And we are now looking at over 3 million and 3.5 million pounds in a month. It's been a big lift. but we've been so blessed by the community in supporting our efforts as it changes every day.
Wow. That really gives you a sense of how many families out there who are working, working families who have been furloughed, laid off in this pandemic, really need help with this. So there's a program that you began at the start of the pandemic in partnership with Florida Blue called Project Share. And this put out-of-work restaurant staff to the task of preparing food for high-risk communities. Can you update us on Project Share? How is that program working right now across the First Coast?
Oh, my gosh. So this is a case of, you know, you're given some lemons, and we were blessed to be able to make lemonade. When the TPC was canceled, we started this project because we had all of this institutional-sized food. We started with 9 restaurants, beginning with the Black Sheep Group. Quickly, Florida Blue came to the table and said, how can we help? At one point, we had 78 furloughed restaurant employees who were being paid through Feeding Northeast Florida, utilizing their kitchens and the food we provided. In addition, Florida Blue has kept their whole food service staff, approximately 40 people, preparing meals. And at our high point, we were at about 5,500 meals a day. We thought something would run out first, and we weren't sure what it was. But it turns out that as our restaurant partners have gone back to work and been able to rehire their employees, they have rolled off, as has some of the intense need in the senior communities we were serving. But it leveled out, and we're doing about 4,000 meals every day. And they're being provided to seniors in need. And Florida Blue has stayed committed for the long haul, at least to the end of the year. We are just so incredibly grateful for that effort. And it's made us able to serve in a way that we had not done in the past, with healthy, nutritious meals. So we're very grateful. It continues on, and we're looking for ways to continue it into the future.
Right. We're speaking with Susan King, Executive Director of Feeding Northeast Florida, about spiking levels of food insecurity in this region due to the coronavirus pandemic. People always ask, how can I help? And I know a lot of times, Susan, people want to maybe drop food off at a local pantry. That certainly is welcomed, but there are other ways that people can really maximize their efforts to help Feeding Northeast Florida, because you do operate across this region in a number of counties. You serve dozens of pantries. Can you explain a little bit about the network and how people can best serve and help your efforts?
You know, most of our work is done through our agency partners, which number about 280 in our 8 counties area right now. Although we lost a large number of them early on in the pandemic, many, many, many have come back, and many new ones have begun where people see need. There's always a list of agency partners on our website. If it's wonderful if people go to those and say, hey, this is in my community, I can support them. But more importantly, or as importantly, is volunteering, giving of your time, advocating for hunger issues, understanding the state of hunger in the United States, and very much importantly in our community and our state, and always fundraising and donating. Food drives were always a staple of our organization and our community, but in this time of COVID, it's not necessarily safe, nor do we want to put additional stressors on the supply chain. So we do ask that monetary donations are the best way to do it, because we can leverage those dollars far, far better than in a retail environment.
Isn't that because of your network? So say I donated $20 to Feeding Northeast Florida. That would go so much farther than people realize, correct?
Absolutely. We can leverage that to anywhere from 4 to 6 times what you will pay for it, because we will buy it by the tractor trailer load at wholesale prices. We're able to negotiate for freight only and be able to take truckloads of food. So, you know, dollars really, really can go much further than the cans of food and the shelf stable that we need in our grocery stores.
And as you said, it's better to donate at a distance right now than to volunteer. you want to keep people safe in this pandemic. Can you update us? How is the pandemic affecting operations like Feeding Northeast Florida? How do you work through that?
We very early on reduced the number of volunteers at our facility at any time. We're typically about 15, maximum 20 people, and they are spread out socially distanced. Masks are 100% required. We've always required gloves. We have a row of hand washing stations. We have also added a thermal facial imaging system so that everybody gets screened before entering the facility, gone through in-depth CDC questionnaires and followed protocols. And I will say, you know, knock on wood and how blessed we are that we have not had any incidents of any kind of outbreak or any volunteers who have been positive. So we rely on volunteers. They are the lifeblood of our organization, but we are treating them as we would anybody else, and that we are very, very, very careful about how we manage them. And we've got a crew of regular volunteers we're so grateful for, but we always welcome more. We've also instituted some regular recurring mobile pantries that are drive-through, very safe, and those volunteers can sign up to participate in those. So they're not in a warehouse environment, but they're outside. They're serving clients just through a car drive-through, and a very rewarding experience. So I encourage people who don't necessarily want to be in a warehouse to consider those.
Right. If there's one silver lining in this challenging time, it's that people are coming together to help, looking for ways to serve, be of service. And if you're one of those people, Feeding Northeast Florida is a great option. As Susan said, you can donate easily online at feedingnefl.org, or you can volunteer safely, as she said, in this pandemic. There are 54 million people food insecure across this country, 18 million children, an unprecedented demand at Feeding America and Feeding Northeast Florida. So do what you can to help them. And thank you, Susan King, who leads this important organization, Feeding Northeast Florida, for bringing us up to date on your efforts. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
And in a moment, new public art is going up in the city's urban core, celebrating the musical heroes of the First Coast, including Ray Charles and others. We'll be right back.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpenn.com for more information. Arbus Magazine, focusing on the arts, business, and culture that enhance the quality of life in our community. 27th Annual Fall Art and Cultural Issue features history, art, and culture in the outdoors. Arbus Magazine, in-depth, in-touch. Arbus.com.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org.
I'm Robin Young. More than 100,000 have joined a group for people with long-term COVID-19 symptoms.
Post-COVID onset diabetes and post-onset lupus. People in tremendous pain. There is really not a single organ that is not being affected.
And now they want to help researchers understand and treat the disease. Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Joshua Powell was number 2 at the National Rifle Association, but this lifelong gun advocate is now turning against the hugely influential organization.
Gun owners across America should be horrified by what I saw inside of the NRA.
Joshua Powell on his time inside the NRA, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The city's La Villa neighborhood was the original storied home of the incredible musical heritage of Jacksonville's African-American performers. A new outdoor exhibit called Artists Pick Artists is going up in La Villa today, and it celebrates more than a century of these musical heroes, including Ray Charles. This is being done through portraits done by local artists. I learned more from Paul Sifton of 927 Events and Glenn Weiss of the Jax Cultural Council. Good to have you. Okay, Paul Sifton of 927 Events on Forsyth. Let's begin with you. This is Artists Pick Artists in La Villa, right there on Forsyth Street at the former Lee and Kate's building. What are we going to be seeing there?
Well, Melissa, I boarded up the windows some weeks or months ago when the problems were with marches and so on. So I ended up with this boarded up window while I'm still working with the city to put a grocery store in there. And so I decided that I wanted to try to color it up a bit down there. And so I got a hold of Art Republic, Jessica, and Glenn at the Cultural Council, and between the three of us, we came up with 8 good artists, local artists, to do different local people that have become successful in their own way in the arts. And so we'll have a sidewalk tour of artwork that will be in the windows that are boarded up.
So activating the space while you're still working to open it to the public. That's cool. So Glenn Weiss, Director of Art in Public Places, this is an example of how you're working with business owners like Paul, it sounds like, to activate the urban core with public art.
Yeah, absolutely. I think now we have seen the, you know, with Art Republic, with the Cultural Council, with the DIA, with DVI, you're seeing a huge number of groups now really using the art to say how downtown can have this kind of energy through just painting our walls and thinking about our history in those places. And I think La Villa is also definitely cutting edge of new stuff happening.
Yeah, I mean, La Villa is the birthplace of Jacksonville's rich African-American musical heritage. So many greats played in the old days of La Villa. So this outdoor exhibit will celebrate more than a century of that cultural legacy. And, you know, this is a way for people, Paul, to, when they come down and look at this, they can learn about that history. And they can also learn about your plans for this old building, this old Lee and Kate's building, which is a story in itself, right?
Yeah, it was first built in 2006. And, 1906. And
yeah, a little older than that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. and has not been utilized for several years because of a fire in it. So I'm looking forward to taking the challenge on and resurrecting it for a new life.
So this is celebrating music and celebrating Jacksonville's talented artists. Glenn, tell me a little bit more about that piece of this.
So all the visual artists are from here from Jacksonville, and they range from some really great artists coming out of the Art League, which is a much more kind of formalized style, to a much more kind of hip-hop style that comes from, like, Tatiana Kay and other artists. And then the musicians range from, you know, our original composer here in Jacksonville, Jay's Rosamund Johnson. Three voice and sing, all the way through to Youngie Ace, who is now, you know, making his career moving forward. Also, it's interesting that two of the artists kind of selected people, Peyton Locke, and oh, I'm blanking.
That's okay. We're taping this. We can edit that out.
Okay. So it's also interesting that they selected Peyton Locke and Vaughn Barlow, two artists who were very much loved here in Jacksonville, who passed away in the last year. So we're kind of also honoring them and their contribution just to our city here.
And Ray Charles, too. You know, of course, he did go to the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind in St. Augustine, but it's my understanding he's the only performer in this exhibit that was not born in Jacksonville, not born and raised in Jacksonville, although he did get his debut at the Jacksonville Ritz Theater, correct?
Yes, absolutely. That's correct. I mean, but at the Ritz, he really learned how to be a, you know, a musician by performing every day for a year until he as a young boy, learned how to survive in the musical world here in Jacksonville and throughout the whole Southeast.
So people need to come on out today for the Artists Pick Artists in La Villa, new public art exhibit featuring and celebrating Jacksonville's African-American musicians. This opens today at 905 West Forsyth Street, downtown, the former Lee and Cates building. And there will be an artist reception and unveiling beginning at 4:30 p.m., thanks so much to Paul Sifton, 927 Events and Catering, and Glenn Weiss with the Cultural Council and Art in Public Places. Guys, can't wait to see it. Thanks for sharing this with us. And go check that out. That's our show. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to tune in tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll see you then. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.